This is a very special episode of the Bicycle Media Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Please stick around for the whole thing. Folks, welcome to another episode of the Bicycle Media Podcast, the podcast dedicated to the health of the cycling industry. This is a very special episode to me, and the world is going through a much needed change, and we're hearing a lot of voices speaking about a lot of stuff that we've perhaps shelved or put behind us that is now in the forefront, and rightfully so. Among the many people in the cycling industry that I've reached out to for a little bit of a chat, my next guest was gracious enough to give me his time, and I want to give him the floor in a moment. I'm speaking to Damon Turner, who's the founder of the LA Bicycle Academy. And this academy, and I'll let him do most of the talking, is a youth program, education program, community bike shop, and youth cycling team with a pretty cool mission. I love the mission: to empower, educate, and develop entrepreneurial and leadership skills in boys and girls between the ages of 8 and 18. Just phenomenal. Gives me shivers just even reading that. Damon, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
You're welcome. Thanks, Cody. Thanks for having me.
So I got a whole slew of questions, and I just want to first just give you the floor and to kind of talk about what's happening from your vantage point. What can you tell us? How can you educate us? What is going on in this world based on your lens?
So that's a big one. Here in LA, it's been tough, man. I mean, obviously, you know, with COVID-19, and then everything that's happened around the country, spearheaded by this incident with George Floyd. And I just think it's I like to call it, at least from my vantage point, a paradigm where we were eventually going to come to this point, you know, based on historical context or historical reality, meaning what's been happening in the country, you know, that obviously people have been aware of, but it hasn't been seen. And with technology and everything else that's going on, we're in a very challenging time. And I think, but I also think we're in a hopeful time that people are taking the initiative to try to understand how we got to this place. And that's the main thing. We have to take a step back and try to understand how we got to where we are. And it's in every facet, as you may know, whatever industry you're in, it has been affected in one way or another, meaning race, or lack of opportunity, racism, you know, and, the willingness to take yourself out the center and just listen is one of the key components for, at least what I'm saying, people getting to that next place, you know? And I think when you do that, what happens is that you experience some of the things that other people have been going through. You know, whether you, as you mentioned, read some literature or through music or study at that place in time, what that person was going through, why Miles wrote that song or whoever that may be. And our cycling community has taken a step and tried to bridge that gap in the best way that they can, you know? And, I think that's part of what our project is about.
Yeah. We're going to definitely dive into the project for sure. In following, brothers, Justin and Corey Williams, well before the incident with George Floyd, You saw two really, and there's many more, but just two really aspiring role models for others, and I think that's what your program is doing. For the rest of us that don't understand what it's like to kind of live in that fear or to not have those opportunities, that is that baffling component. And I think as we learn more about racism through conversation, it's baffling the subtleties of racism. Education racism, healthcare racism, financial racism, those things that we just overlook. You know, your experiences, are we getting better? You know, the conversation through technology, like you said, is more in the forefront. And Egypt and other countries have had monumental changes because of social media. But how is now different than 1992 or, you know, other experiences that you've seen firsthand where, hey, maybe this is now, this is it?
Well, the answer to your first question is like, no, we have not gotten better.
Okay.
We have not gotten better. I mean, it just, once again, it we have come to a point of seeing that what racism has brought upon everything, you know, and that this incident is just a small snapshot of a bigger picture. And so it's where we are, you know, it's where we are. I mean, like, I'm not, you know, like my girlfriend, she's a PhD and she has a lot more knowledge and experience around this, but I've really, really made it a point to sit and listen and watch certain podcasts and around with people that have a better understanding of this. And what I do know is that the part about seeing it for what it is just that we're at that point in time where it's like you can't look, you can't look left or right. It's like we have to take this head on. And the way you take it head on is you start from where do policing start? Like people like just study the origin of policing and you don't have to study it like blame yourself for it, but understand how did policing start? And if you just look at that component alone, powerful, powerful. And you're like, oh shit, no wonder where we're at, you know? And so, and once again, I believe some people are willing to do that. You know, and that's that. In fact, they're going to have to be willing to do that if we're to get through this or get past this and move forward.
So. Well, you brought up a good point that educate yourself and go far back. I think that is the key message is understand a community. You have to go way back and certainly people are learning. I want people to dig and scratch beneath the surface of what's happening right now. I think one of the reasons why some of us in sort of the, you know, white community and I'm up here in Canada, which is more of a logging and oil refining community. My wife and I, and we have these two beautiful children. We looked at each other and we said, wow, we don't know what to do. We don't know what to say. On one hand, we're seeing people put up the black screenshot and then getting chastised for it. Oh, well, you got to do more. And we were really kind of not worried, but we just didn't know what to say. And that's kind of why we started reaching out to people that we knew. And I reached out to a wonderful graphic designer named Andrea, said, these two beautiful children, I want to have these conversations about race. And, you know, we've got CNN on while we're cooking dinner and, you know, what do we need to do and how can we learn? And she said, well, you know, one of the things that you're doing is just asking and that helps. But it's, my question to you is, where are we going to be in 10 years? Do you think, you know, I'm not going to use the word fad, but how are we going to keep the pedals turning, to use a bicycle example, to push forward and make change? Because if what I'm hearing is amazing athletes from the black community aren't giving opportunities, given their skills and their coachability and their good demeanor, how are we going to change that? Because we need to change the world and these inspiring people are being held back.
Cody, I think it's going to be our children. I think it's going to be the next generation. And I'll get into a little bit, but like our project around earning a bicycle encompasses like life tools across the board. So it's like teaching a young person to advocate for themselves. And so like if the beginning of teaching your children is asking questions, that's where it starts, you know? And I believe that if we make a concentrated effort to do that, because it's about passing the baton. Like, I mean, I'm 58. So in my mind, personally, in my spirit, what I think about is what I want to leave for my children. It's not about me. You know what I'm saying? So that includes the bike program also. So I look at it like if a kid comes in and learns how to refurbish a bicycle, they build the confidence to move forward in other aspects of life. And that's even taking up for somebody, like around, you know, just not accepting what exists right now.
Well, let's let's dive into the program a little bit, because I like the idea that there's entrepreneurial skills, representing yourself, leadership skills. Leadership has been, you know, one of the cornerstones of what we're seeing in the past 2 weeks. Good leadership, poor leadership. But let's just dive into the program. Give us a little bit of a history of the LA Bike Academy and what it started as. Is the journey still on point? Has it changed over the years, and some of what you guys are doing? I love it.
So in the beginning, we set out to give support around racing, specifically around junior development. And like in 07, representation wasn't moving fast enough for me. So I started the organization. As I said, the original name was Unity Sports. And the initial goal was to lend support to junior development. And we built a small team around that. And so from 07 to present, that's what we've done. Every year we've supported 8 to 10 riders, predominantly black and brown kids, you know, in communities in the area. And so that's been our mission. And we've been relatively successful. We've had financial support and sponsorship to spearhead that project, you know, for the last 10 years. And so moving forward, we realize that creating an Earn a Bike project would open the door for more kids, because we understand that every child's not necessarily interested in racing, but we know that every child would benefit from being involved with cycling from a general standpoint.
Awesome. I think that's right. You don't necessarily identify yourself as a racer. You know, maybe you want to be a mountain biker, or you're a fixie rider, or BMX.
Right.
The bike has its subcultures. And I've always thought that the successful programs that just present cycling and kind of let the individual gravitate to what they want to do are the most successful. So, you know, what have been some of those successes that you've had? I mean, and we talked sort of previous to the sort of podcast episode that we're doing now about an individual who went to post-secondary through cycling and
correct,
through the,
correct.
Yeah. Like, talk about some of those successes, because that is, you know, proof is in the pudding. But I know, being a goalie coach, when you send folks off to post-secondary as ice hockey goalies or otherwise, man, what a feeling that is. That is just so great. So talk a little bit about some of that.
Yeah. So that young man, he's in the postgraduate program. And I kid you not, Cody, like, there are at least 10, 12 experience or stories that were like that, where a young person comes to cycling. A lot of times they come from a challenging situation, whether it be family or personal. And they put that energy, that negative energy, into the cycling, okay, in the cycling, whatever, competitively, and it's transformative, you know. And we've seen that every step of the way, like kids that we have been involved with, and it's just changed their lives. And so we know that if bike racing does that, then we know that this Earn a Bike project will do the same long term, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's about identifying your community. If someone doesn't see themselves maybe as a team athlete per se in, you know, basketball, baseball, football, or other sports, you know, riding the bike is transformative. Bike shops can be that community hub where everyone kind of gets together. They stop by once in a while. They talk about the latest tech, or, you know, just pick up spare tubes. Why was it important that the academy integrate, you know, that comprehensive hands-on bicycle mechanic, sales and service curriculum? Like that, I love it. Like, that to me is making a healthy cycling industry.
Well, it's about representation, and it's about like opportunities that could easily exist within the industry as a whole. So think about it like this. Say a 16-year-old comes to our program and goes through our Earn a Bike project, and they're on their way to college, or even if they're already a, say, skilled graphic designer, or that's something that they desire to be. Well, we know all the companies that are in the industry, they need graphic designers, they need engineers, they need all these different positions filled. So what we want to do is connect the dots between earning a bike to saying, here's bicycle retail, but guess what? Trek has engineers, designers, you name it, you know. And these are long-term careers that you can pursue after college or with the right training. And the beginning point starts at that bike shop, that local hub that local community, that local space.
And you and I both know this, you know, as youngsters, we don't know what we don't know. We don't know what's out there until we perhaps see it on TV or a parent, guardian, or relative says, hey, have you ever done this? You ever tried this? I just think about, you know, some of the folks that would come through the academy, let's say they stay in bicycle retail. Maybe they are, you know, PBMA mechanic, race mechanic, and a youngster comes in to get their first bike and sees somebody in the Black community working at a shop and says, wow, you know, like, I want to talk to that person. It's the theme that I've heard when we do our interviews with females in the cycling industry. They've often said they would want to see point of sale or staff that are females when they discuss, you know, bike fitting and other experiences that they've had. That to me is the biggest thing. That representation in the shop is huge. Have any of your alumni stayed in the bicycle retail to your knowledge?
Absolutely. Young man named Cameron Corey came to the program. In fact, so he was in a continuation school when I met him. And he graduated, and we had gotten a call about this young man needing a part-time position to kind of occupy his time and to make that transition. And he was hired as a warehouse to shop cleaner, so to speak. I noticed he was up there, young Black kid. It's like, hey, you're working here now, right? And I introduced myself. And a lot of times my introduction to young people is like, could you see yourself being involved with bicycle racing? And they kind of see that kind of question mark on their head or whatever, you know. So, but I asked him, you know, he was curious about it. He became involved in our team. And in fact, he's the one that actually won the first few races that we had ever won. And at that time, I think we had been around maybe 5 or 6 years and we had never won a race. I mean, we participated, did well, competed. And he literally that day won 2 races. And so here's the part of the story that's amazing. I was talking to my girlfriend maybe a month ago, and I was saying, man, Cameron could have been maybe a Cat 2 racer or Cat 1 or been professional. And she said, no, honey, that's not what that whole thing was about. She said, Cameron's been working at that same bike shop for almost 10 years now. Okay. 10 years. And so that's what happens time and time again, just do the bicycle. And so we figure, as you said, like a career in bike retail, I think it's a great career, you know, but how many young people know about it, you know? And so this could be the beginning of that. You know, when you have a project where you earn a bike and you learn the facets of bicycle retail, now you come out of it with these skill sets that are obviously fit for that and beyond, you know. So we're excited about that.
Yeah, I think if you're on the sales floor in bicycle retail, there's communication skills, sales skills. You're learning to understand that there are different types of buyers, some that are very, you know, price-based, or some that want a beautiful bike, or they need those sort of collegiate sales techniques in order to help them find a bike. But those skills transcend the bike industry no matter what. You're going to have to sell something or yourself one day. Well, let's dive into a bit of a bad rap that the bicycle has taken as of recent. I want to ask your opinion on something that's sort of crept up. The bicycle, you know, quote unquote, being used recently as a weapon. And, you know, one of our big brands is in some of these, you know, Getty Images photos of being used as a weapon. How has the bicycle been involved, good or bad, throughout these past few weeks, in your opinion?
Well, when I saw that, it was just another example of the culture of the mentality or that a system that's been put in place to feel that you can literally weaponize what's at your disposal, you know? And, but obviously we know there's the good side too, you know, it's transformative, but it just, you know, I don't think it's a reflection of like what bicycles represent as a whole. I mean, obviously, we know there's the lack of diversity and all the other challenges that, you know, the bicycle industry needs to recognize. But I think that that component or that happening was like just another reflection of just the culture of the country and where we are, that you can, that you feel that you can actually use this bicycle. You know, this is your assigned job as a weapon, you know, and I think the protest as a whole, like I'm so, and I've done this in the last week, I'm putting myself in the shoes of a police officer, right? I'm the police, right? And I have this armor on me and I approach you and you're in a peaceful situation, right? And I have, if I want to, I have control of that situation. Like I have an opportunity to come to you and try to begin to understand what your peaceful protest is about, you know, as opposed to just, you know, attacking. And, you know, it's not good. It's not a good look. And, I just hope that that people see it for what it is, you know, and try to do things to like counter that.
I think worldwide, certainly in North America, again, we're in Canada, where there have been, you know, video snippets of certainly our civic police, but our RCMP and First Nations who have a long history again with the, you know, being taken away from their families and a lot of really big hardships that, you know, our government in Canada is waking up to. The bike industry and what's happening today has seen messaging from different brands and companies. And we'll just stick to the brands. And, you know, some have been well received. Some have been seen as perhaps kind of smoke and mirrors, wax paper, or just to sell more bikes or seem part of the conversation. What's your statement on that? Of, you know, beyond the black screenshot and some of the other hashtags, there have been messages from top down that have been well crafted, or even actions. And again, we talked about the bike as a weapon. I think there was a fugitive distribution chain that stopped giving. They said we're no longer going to supply the police force with bikes.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
yeah. So have companies, in your opinion, certain ones done well with the messaging and followed through with it, be it, you know, the big brands of Specialized, Trek, or otherwise?
I think they have. I think some have. It might be too early to kind of tell what the impact's going to be. I mean, certainly Specialized has been 100% on board with Justin and Legions and what they're doing. Man, them dudes are rock stars, man. I love those dudes, man. By the way, I've been knowing them since they were like babies, bro. Like I saw Justin on the very first long road training ride. Justin was about 12 and we were going to this place called The Rock. It's like a 100-mile ride round trip. I looked over to him. I was like, oh, are you doing the whole ride? And he's like, yeah, I'm going with my dad. So I've been knowing them since they were children. And I'm super proud of them around what they're doing and just making a huge impact. But to your question, yeah, I mean, I think Specialized and some other companies are genuine around the change that they want to see make. And but I think long term it's it remains to be seen, you know. I think some of this to a degree can be, it's in our hands, you know. It's in our hands to like speak up and say, okay, If there are positions in the bike industry that are available for, and Aisha McGowan did this actually. She did an op or like a post that asked folks to send in their resumes around different types of work that they did that she could present to the bike industry. To say, look, here's a graphic designer, engineer, etc. You know, you guys should apply for these jobs if you're interested. And so I think things like that are where we need to get, because it's just a reflection of where the industry is, you know, of where cycling is. I read a piece called The Minority Report. And in that piece, it talked about cycling, infrastructure, equity, et cetera, et cetera. There's one piece in the report that indicated where there is bicycle access, cross all areas, that those places are far less used than areas like where I live, the inner city, where the bicycle is in more demand. Meaning people in LA ride bikes because they have to. They're not like me, nice road bike, I'm going to the beach. They're like, yo, this is how I get to work. This is how I go to a grocery store. I can't afford a monthly MTA pass. And so the important part of that is understanding that people are using bikes, you know, but the equity around the space to do that or the safe space to do that is far less than areas that have it and they're not using it. That doesn't make sense. You know, like you get the resources for bike access, but you're not using it, you know? And so, you know, just understanding what needs to be done and where we need to go with this is just, you know, something that we can need to continue to have that conversation.
Wow. A while back, we had a wheel builder on the podcast who was for a while a civic planner, and he left that job with the government in Australia there to become a mechanic and move on. And he found it to be frustrating and slow. And sometimes you are retroactively fitting in bike lanes and other infrastructure from your forefathers that didn't even respect the bicycle, regardless of when they made some of these decisions. But I just want to touch on something, especially with the Williams brothers. I mean, Corey is continuing to educate us and be a role model. And like all of the folks that speak up, had to deal with some narrow-minded keyboard warriors that said, okay, you know, maybe Corey, you know, these opportunities with USA Cycling didn't come to you because of your ethnicity, but because of your lack of talent.
And right.
Then it was on. Like, I mean, then it was on. These
I know. Just... Oh, I've been watching. I've been reading. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and to me, it's just like, it's baffling. Like, you know, I watch them in videos and in crits. These are consummate professionals, but dynamite athletes that live athletic lifestyle. And you can just tell they are good people. I mean, that's just part of it, right? If we're going to have these role models that, because, you know, the people that are following these riders and like Corey are going to have to deal with these comments. And maybe they are the 10 and 12 year olds that Justin and Corey were and going, Mom, Dad, why would somebody say that? Like, you know, that piece. What do you say to individuals that are speaking up and having to deal with the keyboard warriors? Because it obviously hurts, but they know that it's a narrow-mindedness. You know, what can you say to those folks?
The keyboard warriors?
Well, both. The role models that have to unfortunately deal with it. And then the keyboard warriors that should just stay perhaps in their parents' basements and worry about something else.
Right. Well, so keyboard warriors, what you need to understand about your comment about him not being good enough in cycling, and this is across the board, in the development of cycling, say if you're a Neo Pro U23 rider that comes to a team, maybe you might go to a Pro Tour team. There's a period where you're allowed to develop as a rider. So what does that mean? If you're doing a 4-day stage race and you get through the first 3 days, they allow you to do that. And the part of the point, and I'm just speaking for myself from what I understand, is that there are tons of riders with less talent than Corey that were allowed to do that. And that's a natural part of the sport. Think about it. Like if you have Tour de France riders, take a domestique. Whose job may be to ride the first 15 days. And that's all we need you for. And I'm just using an analogy around the sport or the development in the sport. And so there are a ton of riders, either with less talent or equal talent, that were allowed to not finish time and time and time again. And that's the difference, you know? And so, but once again, I think what I'm so proud of is that they basically took that and created what they have. And that's the good thing about that, you know. So it is about opportunity. Major Taylor, when he was given up, and that was 100 years ago, right? Once he was given opportunity, right, it was no looking back. Like if you read, there's a portion in the book, I wish I could pull it out, because I actually have one of the original autobiographies, the one that he wrote toward the end of his career, right? It's not mine, it's a friend of mine's. But he was talking about the development and how to train, like specifically like to how we do it now. And I'm thinking to myself, this is like in the 1920s. And this guy's talking about cadence and leg speed and upper body relaxation and all this other stuff. And so my point is that given opportunity, I mean, it's about letting that rider develop or giving him the opportunity to develop, you know?
And like you said, they're not getting that opportunity. When we look at the tour, and again, I'm a Canadian, so, you know, hockey is in my blood. I probably learned to skate before I could walk. There are those individuals that have to endure a lot, and the number of, you know, black hockey players is just so small. And we know that that culture is, you know, going through changes, understandably. Do you think that, you know, as time passes and we continue to have brands and teams being literally shooken by, you know, some of these leaders in the cycling community saying, no, we aren't getting these opportunities. You need to change. How can we change? I mean, because tier one sports, there's an entertainment value, and that entertainment industry is tough to maneuver. Hockey is challenging, and athletes like PK Subban and Grant Fuhr, these amazing community members that are just like PK Subban as a hockey player. You see these small clips of him on social media training in the off season like a beast. Like he is dedicated to his craft. And if somebody were to say, well, PK, we don't want you on the team because you're not a great defenseman, that would be mind blowing, because he is, he defends the net. That's his job, but he also puts the puck in the net, you know, and that's an awesome, awesome athlete to have on your team. But, you know, people like Corey or those that come after them, are they going to get more opportunities now that we've kind of awoken up the cycling industry? Are they going to say, you know what, you're going to get to do the 3 days or the 4 days, or we're going to develop you more, or we want more inclusion in the tour?
You know, I would hope so, Cody. I would hope so. It when you think about infrastructure around cycling, if you commit yourself to development, then long term you're going to reap the benefits, and that's what makes Europe so good. Because every pro tour team, if you look at the sort of domino effect, every pro tour team, they sponsor a junior team. They sponsor a U23 team. And sometimes they have sort of what they call an elite team underneath their pro tour team. And so all it's saying is that we're betting on the long game. We're prepared to invest in the future of the sport. And so I just think that specifically around Corey, I think he has everything that it takes to get to that level. I think someone just needs to give him that opportunity to do that, because he did Redlands, and I think he made it to the third day. I may be wrong about that, but all I'm saying is that he's there. You know, he's getting there. And granted, I mean, we know some of these guys are getting younger and younger. I mean, like Quinn Simmons just signed with Trek Segafredo, 18 years old. And so that window to be at that level is just, it's so small, you know. But even that, you know, even Quinn, perfect example. So he's on pro tour, right? But he's not doing 10-day stage races. He's doing 5-day stage races. It's allowing him the time to develop, you know? So, yeah. And I can't believe he made that comment too. Like, I don't know if you know, he made a comment. I think he's the one that said, if you're not good enough, you're not good enough.
Yeah. 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 That's the comment that I read.
Yeah. Which was, you know, like, I mean, come on, man, you know? So, but I mean, he's young, so he gets a pass, you know, young kid, whatever. But the point of all that is that it's about developing and giving the opportunity to develop. And I think it's coming. I think what Legions is doing, like I'm even motivated to say, like, even though we're kind of shifting and focusing on this Earn a Bike program, our junior development program goes hand in hand. And so what that means is that we're absolutely committed to supporting between 5 and 8 riders going into next year.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And And Legion just crushed it on their fundraising campaign.
Oh my last God. Check, 70. I'm going to call those guys up, man. No, I'm going to wait for their call, actually. My pride won't let me reach out. You know, I'm thinking that, and I'm going to put this out there. Justin, Corey, yo, man, I think he raised almost 100K.
Yeah.
And our thing is we're doing 25. We need 25 grand, you know. And once again, our project is more about, you know, creating a service retail infrastructure for the Earn a Bike program, but it'll allow us to support a small junior team for sure. So,
And I think it's important if we look at the ability to support a team from a fiscal standpoint, and we have riders that are moving up, for instance, we need to get those athletes some training in altitude if they're going to, you know, have a stance in the tour, right?
Yeah.
So we're going to have to send them somewhere in the US where they can get some miles in the sky, right, so to speak. Yeah. And that's not going to come cheap.
And can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
So as it relates to development of the sport in general, so when you think about a sponsor who obviously is trying to get a return on their investment around what they do, that's clear. In North America, we have the ability to develop at the highest level. And here's my point. It in cycling right now, the definition of the pinnacle of the sport is Europe. But I would beg to differ. When you think about even what Canada has to offer as far as just racing in general, or Colorado, or the current, let's say, road tour that we have here in North America. My point is that I believe a title sponsor or a big sponsor would probably benefit more from focusing on American cycling and developing it from within. You know, like if the highest altitude mountain is close to what Al Duez might be, then why do we need to go to Europe per se? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm not discounting. All I'm saying is that the Tour of Colorado, Tour of California, Utah, all those races need to be uplifted to the point where the sponsorship dollars are about promoting the sport as a whole to grow it, you know, because the culture is not like it is in Europe. And so that's the justification for a lack of sponsorship, at least part of it, you know. So I just think growing it within would be the benefit to the sponsor long term.
Benefit to the sponsor long term and growing the sport. Do you think it's also tied, however, to maybe television dollars? I mean, we're in the United States, cycling's probably not the top, what, 10 sports? I mean, like, I'll just take
a run at it. That's very true.
But do you think then that it needs some allies in the cycling community? I mean, obviously, you know, he'll never return to have any sort of merits, but somebody like Lance Armstrong or others that can have a say and go, you know what? We need to market our hometown races. We need to market events in the US because there's more opportunity for giving others a chance to compete or stand on the sidelines, right? And chase a rider up a mountain.
right. Allies are important, you know, because they have a platform to say that, you know, hey, this is important. This is how we can grow this, you know, perhaps, you know. But I think it may be a while before something like that happens, but it's like, I think long term, if it's about the fact that if you put more young people on bicycles, and that grows the sport or grows the lifestyle of cycling, then maybe that is the starting point, you know, because we obviously know there are more people that ride recreationally than they do race. And so if we continue that part of it, infrastructure, the industry, careers, as well as representation, then that maybe that should be the center focus. And then everything else would kind of work itself out.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. And perhaps if team sports integrated cycling as best as they could into additional training, off the field training, off the court, off the ice training, people would get a chance to experience it. We spoke to a gal in our podcast who left post-secondary soccer and took up track cycling and set a record for women's 200-meter sprint. And it was just her saying, you know what, I've aged out of this team sport opportunity. Oh, well, I'll try cycling. And then she crushed it. She did amazing. And perhaps that's, you know, an opportunity is to say, hey, you know, your local football, baseball, basketball team, find a way to get on some bikes and crush a hill and see what endurance sports looks like compared to, you know, the sport that you're playing, where perhaps some of these, you know, body systems, cardiovascular, muscular are, you know, short sprints, short challenging sprints. But here now there's, I mean, do you think people understand that a race event has a fair bit of strategy to it?
You know, so this guy said one day, he said, what if you took that high school running back that was 6 feet, 210, and he didn't necessarily have a college career and put him on the track?
Yeah.
Over. Yeah. He's already built for it. He's ready. Like, you know, hey, knee injury. Okay, guess what? Try cycling out.
Yeah.
You know? But we have to be open to that, you know?
Mm, yeah.
So, so the talent is there. The talent is definitely there. I think our involvement, you know, what you're doing is great. You know, just giving me and other people platforms to just speak out and share their stories and their experiences. And, I grew up, understanding what community meant and, that's why I do what I do, you know? And I've had the lived experiences where that young person went from, they could have easily went the opposite way, you know, jail, drugs, or whatever the case may be. And I'm not saying that's always the alternative, but cycling was the common denominator to get them to that next space or that next opportunity. And, it's worked time and time again. So I think using that example, you know, you can always win.
You know, I look forward to seeing many more riders come out of your program. I look forward to the months ahead, the years ahead, as the cycling community becomes more diverse. And like you said, some of these athletes come in and absolutely crush the competition to prove that it can be done. And I hope the next time I walk into a local bike shop, I do see more diversity, because like you said, it is super important. So Damon, thanks so much. I love it. I'm really glad you were able to carve out some time, and, I look forward to, perhaps chatting with you again soon.
All right, Cody. Thanks a lot. Thanks for the time.
Big thanks to Damon for his time. I found the conversation to be uplifting, educational, and hopeful. And I like that he said, you know, it starts with our children. Now we're all learning. We're all learning from those that have the gift to educate us. And my observation of what I see online and people sharing posts about great literary works is that there's this growing library that we're all creating to learn more. And Damon mentioned it, you know, go back and look at the policing and just the history of that. But one piece that I wanted to interject into everybody's libraries is performing arts. And I'm going to be throwing a laser-focused dart at the dartboard at the post-bop movement of the 1960s. And one 60-second passage of music, which I'll play for you, that changed the course of my life, made me study jazz musicians, their history, some of what they went through, as a mere 15-year-old who had recently dropped out of high school. Yes, I dropped out of high school and graduated on time, but during the time away from structured schooling, I read a lot of books and even wrote some essays on jazz musicians. And in one in particular, a then 17-year-old Tony Williams playing with the Miles Davis Quintet. Music and culture, synonymous, they go together. And certainly when there is a lyric to describe what the singer or composer is feeling, we get that smack dab in the face. But what if there is instrumental music being performed? And what does that have to, force the listener to kind of glean from? 1964, Civil Rights Act, 63, I Have a Dream. And you can go all the way back in time to field songs to add to your library. I'm saying, hey, add music, add performing arts to your library of things that you are consuming to learn more about what others are going through. So I'm going to play a little piece of music for you now. The composition is So What, from the 1964 live recording, Miles Davis, My Funny Valentine, Four and More. And we're going to listen to the infamous track, So What. And now the tune's going to begin with that famous bass line played at a blistering tempo by Ron Carter. Herbie's going to join him on the piano. They've just returned back from a set break, and Tony's going to start playing the drums as Miles takes to the stage. Audience is going to give him a little bit of a welcome. And then what begins once they're done playing the head of the song is they're going to just rip through this amazing piece of music, and I want you to just listen to the banter between Tony and Miles. Buckle up. Thanks for tuning into the episode, Spicicle Media Podcast.